The World is supported by Israel Story, a podcast that tells extraordinary stories about regular people living in Israel, the kind you won't see on the news or online. The show kicked off season four with a miniseries called The Wall, beginning with the gorgeous tale of a Jewish Arab baby born at the Western Wall in the middle of the Six-Day War. Hosted by Mishy Harman and brought to you by Tablet Magazine and PRX. Subscribe to Israel Story on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, israelstory.org, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The U.S. says that Turkey has agreed to pause its offensive along its border with Syria. The next 5 days will show if that announcement has weight. The president thinks so.
It's really a great day for civilization. It's a great day for civilization.
But the Kurds appear to be putting conditions on the temporary peace plan. Meanwhile, a revolving door of diplomats has been testifying before Congress at the impeachment inquiry. A former diplomat worries about what he's been hearing.
It just seems like it's broken down, like they don't run the standard operating procedures of the National Security Council and of conducting diplomacy.
And tomorrow is a tough day for American scotch drinkers. 25% tariffs get slapped on imports.
It's a big number.
Last call before prices go up. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. The U.S. has convinced Turkey to stop its offensive against the Kurds in northern Syria. Vice President Mike Pence made the announcement today in Ankara.
We think the agreement today first ends the violence, which is what President Trump sent us here to do.
The World's Shirin Jafari joins me now. So what is the latest news from Turkey, Shirin?
Marco, tonight, Vice President Mike Pence, along with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, were in Ankara, and they were there to meet with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and to find a way out of the situation in northern Syria. And also tonight, Vice President and Secretary of State held a press conference, and they announced an agreement between the U.S. and Turkey to stop any military action in the Turkish-Syria border.
What do we know about the details of this agreement?
Well, Mike Pence called this agreement a ceasefire, and he said it would last about 5 days, and it would allow the Kurdish fighters to leave the area and move out of the zone that's about 20 miles south of the Turkish border. Pence said this will help avoid further conflict and bloodshed in the area.
We heard from people all over the country whose hearts were heavy with the loss of life in this conflict over the last week, long to see it brought to an end. And I believe their prayers, the strong leadership that President Trump provided to this moment, and the cooperation with President Erdogan and Turkey has made this possible.
So presumably this will stop the bloodshed for now, but what comes after?
There's so much that we don't know at the moment, Marco. For example, who is going to enforce this? Where will the Kurdish fighters go? And what about the Assad forces that are now very much present in the region? Will they abandon the areas that they have taken? We just don't know.
And what about President Trump? Has he reacted to this news?
Well, let's just remember that all this started after President Trump gave the green light to President Erdogan to enter northern Syria. But after there was wide condemnation from the international community, Trump had to find a way to fix this. After the announcement of the agreement, he basically said this is a victory for all.
But this is an incredible outcome. This outcome is something they've been trying to get for 10 years, everybody, and they couldn't get it. Other administrations, and they never would have been able to get it unless you went somewhat unconventional. I guess I'm an unconventional person.
The World's Shirin Jafari, thank you for this update.
You're welcome, Marco.
One detail on this news, there have been contradictory reports from the Kurds about accepting the Pence-Erdogan agreement. Vice President Pence also talked today about coordinating efforts with Turkey on keeping ISIS prisoners contained in northern Syria. Hundreds have already escaped, according to Kurdish officials. Joe Biden made a reference to it at this week's Democratic presidential debate.
What is happening in Iraq is going to be, in Afghanistan, as well as all the way over to Syria. We have ISIS. It's going to come here.
This has also been echoed by other American politicians, but suggesting ISIS is coming to U.S. shores, is that fear-mongering or a real threat? The World's Rupa Shenoy reports.
Biden might have gotten a bit carried away. That's what Bruce Hoffman thinks. He's a Georgetown University professor who focuses on counterterrorism and homeland security at the Council on Foreign Relations.
There's no suggestion that they have the ability to attack in the United States.
Hoffman says presidential candidates should be careful about how they talk about risks because people could panic. And that's what terrorists want. Right now, he says, the more immediate threat from ISIS is to Europe. And that's what President Trump pointed out when he was asked about foreign ISIS fighters escaping from custody in Syria.
Well, they're going to be escaping to Europe. That's where they want to go. They want to go back to their homes, but Europe didn't want them from us. We could have given it to them. They could have had trials. They could have done whatever they wanted. But as usual, it's not reciprocal. You know my favorite word, reciprocal. That's all I want.
But many members of Trump's own party have condemned his actions in Syria as endangering the U.S. And Hoffman says Biden and others are right that the escaped ISIS fighters could recruit and build networks on the ground and online that could plan attacks inside the U.S. He says the U.S. will have to learn to multitask because it's also facing increasing domestic terrorist acts like mass shootings.
This is what I would argue makes the current situation so much more challenging, is that we have now very serious domestic threats. And unfortunately, the foreign ones that we've been grappling with for nearly two decades now haven't gone away either.
And domestic counterterrorism officials probably weren't expecting the situation to change so rapidly, says Adnan Kafaya. He worked on Homeland Security and counterterrorism in the State Department and White House for 16 years under both Democratic and Republican administrations.
I certainly don't think that this was something that, you know, Homeland Security officials had counted on.
He points to the counterterrorism strategy released just last month by the Department of Homeland Security. It talks about increasing domestic threats from the far right and white supremacist groups and suggests the threat from ISIS inside the U.S. is in check.
I don't think that at the time that strategy was written, and again, this was just a month ago, the U.S. officials were counting on the fact that Turkey would roll into Syria and that a lot of these camps and these prisons would be overrun or at least abandoned. That is a new factor that hasn't been taken into account, and it would lead me to think that the government probably is not prepared.
And the American public isn't prepared either, says Farah Pandith, a counterterrorism expert who served in the Obama administration and wrote the book How We Win, about defeating extremist threats. She says Americans are deeply divided, and that leaves us more vulnerable. Pandith says ISIS wouldn't have to stage a big attack in order to have a devastating impact.
They simply need to set off a series of violent attacks in ways that will fundamentally send fear through America, knowing that it will unleash a whole series of conversations with Americans who are asking questions about our identity, who we are, and what we stand for.
So Pandith says what leaders should really be focusing on is finding ways to knit the American people back together.
What the candidates should be talking about is their real need for a policy around stopping the spread of the appeal of the ideology so that groups like this cannot build new armies.
The events in northern Syria over the past 10 days have implications for all the countries in the region, among them Israel. After Trump abruptly changed his policy in Syria, many Israelis were left wondering if their relationship with the U.S. would also change. Tzipi Livni is a former foreign minister in Israel, and she says the message that the U.S. is sending to the region is problematic.
Whatever they may be.
The idea that the United States basically leaves the region and abandons the Kurds or give them, I don't want to say permission, but something like this to the hands of Erdogan, knowing that the next day he's going to invade and start a war against them, not to use other words like massacre. So this is something that is unacceptable. And not only Israel is worried now, there is no vacuum in the Middle East. And therefore, when the United States is not here, somebody else would be here. I am concerned not only as an Israeli, I am concerned as a citizen of the region and a citizen of the world.
Israel and the U.S. are historically close allies, seemingly more so with Trump in the White House. What do you think this latest move in northern Syria means for that relationship?
The relations between Israel and the United States are of a strategic nature for both states. And for many years, it was also bipartisan. without any connection to the question, who is the American president and who is the Israeli prime minister? We see a kind of a change in the last few years. And when the message coming from the United States is that, you know, this is a place thousands of miles away, why should we be there? It is troublesome.
Yeah, and Israeli media reported yesterday that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will travel to Israel following his meeting with the Turkish president. What do you think Pompeo is actually going to hear from the Israelis?
What you heard from me, that, you know, it's a difficult neighborhood to live in the Middle East. So it's very important for the bad guys, and it's clear that Iran is a bad guy, and Hezbollah, its proxy in Lebanon, is part of the bad guy, and Erdogan is also abusing his power in a manner that is quite problematic in the region. And it's important for them to understand that the United States would not sit aside while saying America first.
I mean, I think about a lot of the leaders you just mentioned. I mean, they'd say they're simply defending their national sovereignty, and Trump, for the most part, would support that.
You know, the idea of, okay, let's give everybody or every state or every leader to use what each one calls his national sovereignty, it's a message that is problematic not only to the region, but also to the U.S. itself. I mean, to be a superpower, to lead the free world, the meaning is also to take a position. It's also about those that are respecting democratic values and those that are not massacring their own people or others, even with the excuse of defending their own sovereignty.
In Israel's most recent election, Benjamin Netanyahu ran on the message of being very close to Trump. There were huge billboards in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv showing smiling Bibi and smiling Trump. They're shaking hands. But this is what the prime minister said just last week.
We continue to remember the fundamental rule that guides us. Israel will defend itself by itself against any threat.
Zippy Livni, what did you hear in that remark from Benjamin Netanyahu?
Israel never asked United States to send troops to Israel to defend Israel. This is what we are doing with our forces. When you look at the geopolitical situation, what our enemies, what they see when they are looking at Israel, they see that Israel is a strong state. They see an army which is maybe the strongest in the region. But they also see a strategic alliance, a strategic relationship between Israel and the United States. And therefore, the idea that we would defend ourselves, of course. But when it comes to the entire defense concept, it's not just about using an army. It's about allies, alliances, and this is something that needs to be kept.
Security experts in Israel have voiced concern over this move playing into Iranian hands and empowering Iran's position near Israel's northern border with Syria. How does that impact Israel's strategic position in the region?
I just, during the United Nations General Assembly, I was in New York. I met different leaders from Europe, from the region, and the message was in one clear voice that Iran is posing a threat, that it needs to be stopped. And I think that this time, when the world wants to handle with Iran, it's time not to focus just on the nuclear program, but to look at it in a broader manner and to give an answer, one, to their nuclear aspiration, the other, to their provocation and their long missile project that threatens also other states in the region. So now I think that the international community should look at it in a broader manner.
Zippy Livni is a former foreign minister in Israel. She's now at the Future of Diplomacy Project at Harvard University. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. This is the world. Yesterday here on the show, we were all over a story on sustainable wool, but today it's because dairy farmers in the Netherlands are furious. They feel picked on for contributing to climate change. Despite its small size, the Netherlands is a massive agricultural powerhouse. Cows and pigs there, like everywhere, produce a lot of manure, which releases a lot of nitrous oxide. That gas is 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. According to The Hague, has ordered the Dutch government to cut those emissions faster than planned. That means farmers could see their herd sizes cut. Misha Bauer is a Dutch farmer and a spokesperson for the Farmers Defense Force, an advocacy group for farmers. He's been taking part in the protests. Misha, why are Dutch farmers so angry?
Because the government is going crazy, in our opinion. All the rules are never stop, you know. One day is this rule and tomorrow it's another one. And for decades we've been feeling ignored and everything is getting more strict and it never stops. And that's why we're coming in action right now.
As you probably know, though, the Dutch government is under a court order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. You probably know what the science says. Cows and pigs produce a lot of manure, which produces nitrous oxide emissions. I mean, those emissions are 300 times more potent than carbon dioxide. Why shouldn't the Dutch government be focusing on reducing herds of livestock?
First, the way that they calculate the emissions of the pollution, you know, or the values in Holland are way more strict than in, for example, Germany, the country right next to us. In Holland, the formula for calculating carbon dioxide is 100 times more strict than in Germany, and it's the exact same pollution, you know? That's just not fair, you know? It's the same animal, the same they produce, and we're getting cut on the amount of animals, and in Germany and in the rest of Europe, everything can continue.
Are you willing to accept that maybe Germany isn't doing enough and that the Dutch government is doing the right amount to reduce carbon emissions?
I don't think that's the case because all the other industries in Holland, they can expand and they can expand. Like, we've got a very big airport in Holland. It's called Schiphol in Amsterdam. And we just heard yesterday that they can expand for 40,000 more flights a year.
What steps are Dutch farmers willing to take to reduce nitrous oxide emissions?
Well, I'm sure that there is a problem, you know, with pollution. But if there is, then I think they should look at other industries first instead of always to the farmer, because the farmer always gets blamed for everything.
Well, the Dutch government is also considering permanently lowering speed limits. That's another way of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So it's not just farmers who are being asked to bear the burden. I'm just wondering, I mean, don't you want to be part of a larger effort to reduce carbon emissions?
I think we do, but we're feeling that we are always getting blamed for everything and it should stop right now.
So does that mean you plan more protests or are you going to wait to hear what the Dutch government is proposing?
Our first protest was at the 1st of October. We made a really big statement and we gathered a lot of people, almost 25,000. And the 2nd of October, everything continued like normal. So that's why we went again yesterday. And more industries are going with us, you know. It's not just farmers anymore. It's also truckers and the building companies. And I even got a call from a hospital who wants to join us as well because the healthcare getting blamed for a lot of stuff too.
Do you see this as a kind of urban versus rural fight?
Nah, I don't know about that, but I'm talking to a lot of people lately and everybody is agreeing with us because everybody has something bothering them and they're always whining on Facebook with their friends and now everybody is happy that we're finally taking action.
I'm certain that some climate activists don't agree with you.
No, of course, but they will never agree with us on anything. That's our complete opposite.
Misha Bauer, a Dutch farmer and a spokesperson with the Farmers Defense Force, an advocacy group for farmers in the Netherlands. Mr. Bauer, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Another story now about conflict and climate change. ExxonMobil will be on trial next week. New York's attorney general is suing the energy giant for allegedly defrauding stockholders. The accusation? ExxonMobil downplayed the risk of how climate change policies could hurt the company's bottom line. Inside Climate News reporter Nicholas Kuznets will be covering the trial. He says it hinges on a price estimate, or two prices really, that ExxonMobil assigned to its carbon emissions.
This carbon price, it's a way for businesses to estimate the financial impacts of future climate policies. So the case hinges around the fact that Exxon didn't have one price. It had two different prices. So one of these prices, it disclosed to investors, but there was another price that it was using, and this one it did not disclose. And it used this to actually evaluate which oil and gas projects it was going to be investing in. So the key point here is that this internal cost was lower than the public-facing one. So what the Attorney General is saying is essentially Exxon was publicly showing investors, hey, we're assuming there's going to be some steep regulations that'll make carbon pretty expensive in the future. But then internally, they were actually assessing a much lower cost that was assuming regulations would be much more limited.
So the New York Attorney General is basically alleging through this suit that ExxonMobil was cooking its carbon books.
Yeah, I mean, the central claim is that Exxon was exposing investors to greater risks. And one of the really important impacts of what they were doing is if you put a lower cost on carbon, it's going to nudge investments towards higher emitting projects. And that's exactly how it worked out in terms of what Exxon ended up investing in.
What does ExxonMobil say about these charges?
So Exxon doesn't dispute that it did use two different costs. What it says is they had different purposes and the company had good reasons to use one set of costs to model what the demand for oil would be in 2040 and a totally different set to say, okay, well, what will our refinery be paying for any emissions that come out of it?
So, Nicholas, your reporting found that this carbon pricing isn't just some academic exercise. It actually had real-world impacts on how Exxon invested, particularly in Canada's tar sands or oil sands region. What does that area look like, and how much did ExxonMobil invest there?
The oil sands are a huge part of Exxon's portfolio. About 30% of its oil reserves are in the oil sands. So this is in northern Alberta. It's a mix of low-grade hydrocarbons with sand, and it takes a lot of energy to convert it into something that you can put in a pipeline and get to a refinery. So using all that energy, it costs a lot. So what some of the evidence that the Attorney General has come across shows is that if you apply this high price, the one that's being disclosed to investors, it really doesn't look good in the tar sands.
This case hinges on a pretty technical argument over this proxy carbon pricing. What are the stakes if ExxonMobil wins or loses?
For Exxon, it could face hundreds of millions or even billions of dollars in fines. But beyond just Exxon, this is the first major climate change case to go to trial in the country. There's more than a dozen other cases in which cities and counties, even the state of Rhode Island, are suing energy companies, trying to make them help pay for the costs that they're facing to build seawalls, you know, to address flooding. I mean, there's this major question currently, which is who is going to pay for all the costs that society is going to face? And increasingly, that question is being sent to the courts, and this is the first major look at it in the U.S. legal system.
Inside Climate News reporter Nicholas Kuznets, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
For more on the case, check out Nicholas's reporting at theworld.org. American Scotch lovers know where to go to get a good drink.
Light, delicious, flavorful.
Scotland, of course, but starting tomorrow, imported Scotch will cost a bit more.
We feel we've been dragged into a trade dispute, which I believe is about aircraft.
Scotch gets caught in Trump's latest trade war that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. In Washington, the impeachment drum bangs on. Today, the U.S. ambassador to the European Union, Gordon Sondland, took his turn in front of congressional investigators. In his written opening statement, Sondland said President Trump directed diplomats in Ukraine to work with his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, to investigate Vice President Joe Biden. It's another example of how unusual the practice of diplomacy has become under the Trump administration. Michael McFaul was U.S. ambassador to Russia under President Obama. He's now a professor of political science at Stanford University. Gordon Sondland, not a career diplomat. He's a businessman who made a large donation to a presidential campaign. Ambassador, how unusual is it for someone like that to become an ambassador?
It's not unusual, unfortunately. We have lots of political appointees who are ambassadors, and many of them got those positions by giving large financial contributions to presidential candidates, and in his case, to the inauguration party, where I understand he gave $1 million. And tragically, and wrongly in my view, Democrats and Republicans have been doing that for many decades. And I think the case of Ambassador Sondland kind of underscores why that's not such a prudent policy, because you have people like him that don't understand foreign policy, who are out of their depth of expertise. And in this case, you know, maybe involved in something that's illegal.
But how often do politically appointed ambassadors get sent to sensitive posts like the EU, where Sondland was sent, where real foreign policy chops are required?
Again, in my view, too many times. EU ambassador traditionally is a political appointee. The ambassador to the United Kingdom, Germany, France are all political appointees. And I want to stress there are some political appointees that have expertise. I, after all, was a political appointee. I want to state for the record, I only gave Barack Obama, I think, $250. So I don't think I was there because of my financial contributions. But I had worked 3 years at the White House, at the National Security Council. I'd worked most of my life on U.S.-Russian relations, published lots. So there is a category like me who are experts who are also political appointees, but the vast majority of political appointees are donors with almost no foreign policy experience. And I think that practice needs to stop.
I mean, they're not just involved in policy. Sondland's also involved, allegedly, in this attempt to smear Joe Biden. He told the impeachment inquiry in the House today that Trump himself directed diplomats to work with his personal attorney, Rudy Giuliani, on the Biden issue. How significant do you think that is?
Well, if it's true, it's very significant and very wrong. And I appreciate that Ambassador Sondland is now telling the truth about it. But it's also clear as day to me, given the text of his conversations with other ambassadors from last week that were released after Ambassador Volker testified, that he went along with this scheme. You know, Ambassador Taylor, somebody who's been a public career government official for 3 decades, very clearly said in those texts, I'm not going along with this scheme. And I think that shows the difference between career ambassadors, those who have worked in the State Department for decades, and those that purchased their position, you know, during an inauguration party for President Trump.
I want to turn still on the diplomacy tip to this letter that got leaked yesterday from Donald Trump to Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, dated 9th of October, the day of the Turkish incursion. The final lines are, don't be a tough guy, don't be a fool. Trump said, let's work out a good deal. I don't want to be responsible for destroying the Turkish economy. How common is that kind of language in diplomatic correspondence?
Well, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think there's ever been a letter like that written by the President of the United States. You know, I worked at the White House for 3 years. I wrote some letters for President Obama to other leaders. Generally, that's how it works, by the way. The National Security Staff does the first draft of those letters. It then gets chopped, is the verb, edited by senior people before it reaches the President. And that language is shocking, extraordinary, and by the way, makes our president look extremely weak. I don't understand what objective is being secured by that letter. And moreover, Marco, I think it really underscores the breakdown of standard operating procedures when it comes to the making of American foreign policy and its implementation. Both the Ukraine story and now this story and this letter just underscore it's broken. The interagency process is not working. The president is not sitting down there in the White House Situation Room with his Secretary of Defense, with his Secretary of State, deliberating on the policy. And then they're just implementing it in a rather ad hoc, you know, way. And I'm being diplomatic there by using that adjective. And what suffers is American national interest, this improvisation, privatization, personalization of American foreign policy is not advancing our security interests.
Ambassador Michael McFaul, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
It wasn't very many days or even hours ago that Brexit watchers ever thought British Prime Minister Boris Johnson would utter these words.
I want to stress that this is a great deal for our country, for the UK. I also believe it's a very good deal for our friends in the EU.
That's right. European leaders in Brussels have given their unanimous backing to Britain's latest Brexit proposal, a key sticking point, the border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. The new proposal avoids border barriers, but leaves some customs checks in place. Johnson's deal still needs approval from Parliament back in London. There is a special Saturday session to vote on that. Success is far from guaranteed. Some key members of Parliament from Northern Ireland oppose Johnson's proposal. Meanwhile, in Scotland, there's another non-Brexit cause for concern, sales of scotch. Tomorrow, single malt whiskies will get a bit more expensive for Americans. President Trump is slapping a 25% tariff on imported scotch. It's the latest move in a 15-year battle between the U.S. and the EU over subsidies for a completely different product, European aircraft. The World's Orla Barry went to Scotland and spoke with people there who are drowning their sorrows.
So, three things to make Scotch whiskey. You need water, malted barley, and yeast. And at Deanston, we get all our barley comes from central Scotland.
Deanston Distillery is about 30 miles outside Glasgow. It's a former cotton mill converted to a whiskey distillery in 1966. Their speciality, of course, is single malt scotch. About a quarter of it goes to drinkers in the United States. And that's why news of these impending tariffs is a big worry.
Initial disappointment. We feel we've been dragged into a trade dispute, which I believe is about aircraft. And it feels slightly unreal as a craft Scotch whisky producer, we're having to pay a massive tariff.
John Alden's title is Head of Commercial Excellence at Deanston Distillery. Whisky is in my blood, he says. Alden's father was a customs and excise man whose job was to check if whisky distilleries were obeying tax laws. As a child, Alden says he remembers his dad pouring a bottle of illicit whisky down the sink. Every business faces challenges, but Alden says it's tough to say just how bad a 25% tariff will be.
It's a big number. Will that slow it down? I don't know. We've worked very hard to build our brand. We have a brand ambassador who, you know, goes around the US permanently just promoting the values of our brand. We like to think that we'll be resilient, but genuinely we don't know. Will people switch to something else? I hope not, but it's going to be challenging.
It's not just Deanston Distillery that's facing a challenge. The largest and most valuable market for the whole single malt scotch industry is in the US. The new tariffs were introduced on a series of EU goods in retaliation for aircraft subsidies by Brussels. But the Scottish Whisky Association, which represents distillers here, says this 25% tariff will not just hurt Scotland, but the US economy too.
Of course, there will be knock-on impacts for employment in Scotland, but also in the United States.
Graham Littlejohn is the association's director of strategy.
There's a great crossover of investment between the United States and Scotland and the UK. There's a lot of casks from the bourbon industry that come across to Scotland for Scotch whisky maturation. Nobody wins in a trade war, and this is going to damage the economies on both sides of the Atlantic.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, did raise the issue with President Trump during a phone call earlier this month. But so far, there's no sign the tariffs will be revoked. Littlejohn is still hopeful that Trump might change his mind.
One of the things in this dispute that we really need to focus on is the special relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom. And yes, the special relationship between President Trump and Prime Minister Johnson. The United States has a great love of Scotch whisky. We want to see that continue. And I'm sure President Trump wants to see that continue, given his Scottish roots and given the fact that he has Trump brands of Scotch whisky.
The timing of the US tariffs couldn't be worse for Scotland. The threat of a no-deal Brexit means producers are worried about possible new taxes from the EU as well. But John Alden is upbeat. Looking around Deanston Distillery, the place is packed with tourists on a rainy Thursday afternoon. Among them are Ray and Cheryl, a couple from Los Angeles. Ray is clearly the whiskey expert.
I drank it. I said, light, delicious, flavorful, almost like the greatest cognac in terms of the flavour and how it hits your palate.
But when it comes to the US tariffs, he's reluctant to give his opinion.
I would just like to say I would love to see the economy of the world do well. If there are tariffs can be removed, then there's no antagonism or warfare worldwide. We can all work together. But I would very much like there not to be any impediment to bringing this incredible whiskey back to the States.
Another American couple, Logan and Christina from Denver, are a little more vocal.
Yeah, it's very sad to hear.
Yeah, disappointing.
So how many bottles can we take back? I think four. We need to take four back. Buy a new suitcase, it'll be cheaper.
Would you prefer if your president didn't introduce tariffs on Scottish whiskey?
I would prefer if he did not. Yeah.
I leave them to their whiskey tasting and ask John Alden how he would convince bourbon-drinking Americans to stand up for Scotch.
Well, I'm biased, of course. We actually have very close links with the US bourbon industry. The vast majority of our whisky is matured in bourbon casks. There's a gentle taste that makes Deanston a very enjoyable dram.
But you'd go for a Scotch over bourbon any day?
You know, I like to try different whiskies, but absolutely.
For The World, I'm Orla Barry, Doon, Scotland. Wild
Lancome is a band based in Dublin. They're at the forefront of an Irish folk music revival. They sing traditional songs, but they're focused on the modern world. They take on controversial things like Brexit. One big worry for Lancome, a potential hard border between Northern Ireland and their home in the Republic of Ireland. Not so long ago, the two sides were in pitched battle over that border. So Brexit and borders have Ian Lynch and Rady Pete, two members of Lancome, very worried.
Yeah.
It's just a really uncertain time, both in the south and in the north. Just that worry of kind of any kind of a border. No one wants to go back to the way it was in the 70s and 80s.
And 90s.
Yeah, like it's just a really big question. It's also been very interesting to see the viewpoint of the English politicians, you know, like what they kind of say about Ireland. And it's been a bit eye-opening, I think, for everyone. In terms of like how they view Ireland as a country, you know.
What has changed, do you think, in what you're hearing in those views?
I've just been surprised at the kind of lack of understanding. I always assumed that like there would be like kind of an understanding of the situation in Ireland and how things work and like the kind of delicacy of certain issues or whatever. And it just seems that like maybe that's not common knowledge.
Maybe it's just a whole generation of people that don't remember the Troubles.
Well, we're talking about like politicians at the very highest level here.
Yeah, they should,
you know,
really remember it. Yeah, and it should be their job to know about it.
I mean, you had like one English politician, Patel. She came out 2 years ago and she said, well, you know, if the Irish don't kowtow, we could threaten them with food shortages. And for someone to have that, I mean, she's never read up about the famine or, you know, there's just a big blank there in some people's knowledge about Irish and English history and what's gone down between the two countries over the last few hundred years. It's just been quite shocking.
There is one curious thing about Brexit, though. Conversations about nationalism and identity are now very public and made so partly because of Brexit. So there's a darker xenophobic anti-immigration side, but there's also the pride in tradition. And given that Lancome is at the forefront of the traditional Irish music revival, I'm wondering how you feel about being champions for tradition. Is it an awkward moment?
That is a really difficult question, because I think that like a pride in the tradition of where you're from doesn't always equals like nationalism. I think you can be very proud of the cultural tradition and kind of be immersed in that and yet not be championing national borders. And you know what I mean? They're not the same thing for me personally.
Yeah, right. And I think also as a band, we've also, you know, been at pains to point out that there's no such thing as purity in the Irish tradition. And if you look at the history of the songs and the tunes and the instruments that are used, it's been a constant case of cross-fertilisation. So I think this idea that traditional music is somehow bound up in some kind of jingoism or bigotry, I think it's not true at all. It's just not the case if you look at the tradition historically. But with respect to being seen as like some kind of champions of the tradition, I don't really think that's not how we see ourselves.
Yeah,
either.
You're never going to view yourself as a champion.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
No. How do you think that's all mirrored in the people who come to your shows, like people in their 20s and 30s who are really digging this folk music revival?
I mean, I think, you know, we always get a great mix of people coming to our gigs, and that's what I've always really enjoyed. You know, playing in this band, I've played in bands since I was young, but I've never seen this kind of thing where you would get like, you know, you'd have some mad looking crusty with tattoos on her face sitting beside a traditional singer in their 70s, sitting beside, you know, a 20-year-old whose parents brought them to the gig, you know, like, and having just this really wide mix of people who are really getting a buzz from the same music, you know, I think that's a really special thing and I really enjoy that.
Ian Lynch and Rady Pete there of the group Lancome. Their new album, The Live Long Day, comes out next week. When the young people dance, they do not dance forever. It is written in sun with the softest of feathers. American farms are facing a labor shortage. Farmers are getting older, and many of their kids are not following in their footsteps. California's home to some of the nation's biggest farms. That's also where the labor shortage is most acute. Many farm workers there have traditionally come from Latin America, but less so today with migration slowing down. The World's Marnette Fideris went to see how one company is handling the shortage and turning to technology.
Before iceberg lettuce ends up in a McDonald's burger or a salad at Olive Garden, there's a good chance it was shredded and prepped at Taylor Farms. It's a massive processing plant in Salinas, California, where there are so many farms, it's sometimes called America's Salad Bowl.
So we're heading out to the floor now. It's a little bit wet.
Millions of pounds of lettuce are moving through this warehouse. It's extremely loud and cold. Workers wear ear protection. They're bundled up. And the greens move on conveyor belts, getting chopped, washed, and then packaged. That's when the robots come in.
This is a robotic packing system called a quick pick. But then what this does is it uses suction to pick up each bag and carefully place it in the box.
Marcus Schabel is VP of operations here at Taylor Farms. In another room, more robots are stacking boxes. Not long ago, people did this work. Today, employees are monitoring the robots instead.
Each person, they're going to be responsible for clearing that line and resetting it and making sure that the machine has everything it needs for consistency.
You hear about robots replacing workers in all sorts of different places, but this is what it looks like in agriculture. The robots are responding to a shortage. They do what fewer people are willing to do, tough manual work in a rural area. It's also work that doesn't pay as much as Silicon Valley, just up the road. Mostly immigrants work here, and they're not coming into numbers they used to. Schabel knows this very well.
Labor has gotten tighter. We have many people who have worked here for 10, 15, 20 years, and they are getting a little bit older, and a lot of their children aren't necessarily following behind their parents' footsteps. We're not necessarily in trouble today, but if we don't start working on it, there will come a time when there just aren't enough bodies.
Ana Gutierrez has been with Taylor Farms for 23 years. Her job has changed dramatically since she started working in agriculture when she was just 16. She worked the fields cutting cauliflower after arriving from Mexico. Later, she became a packer. All the work was manual. She says when she first saw machines in the plants, she thought, good, work will get easier. She volunteered to learn. She saw that her job security could hinge on her ability to change with technology.
Hola, buenas tardes.
To keep longtime workers like Gutierrez, the company is now training them how to use the new robots and in Spanish.
We don't want them to feel in any way threatened. We want to bring them along for the ride.
That's Schabel again with Taylor Farms. He says the goal is for employees to gain new skills and to become operators, technicians for the new machines. But some worry that not everyone will survive these changes.
The way I think of this is, yes, it's going to be a job for two or three mechanics, five or six technicians. But that's about it. I mean, they will eliminate hundreds, you know, thousands of jobs.
Crescencio Diaz is with the union at Taylor Farms, Teamsters. He sees companies turning to automation as one way to keep labor costs down while competing with cheaper goods, a reality that can leave workers out of a job.
You might have a lot of mechanization, and still you have a lot of population. What are you going to do with them? What are you going to put them to work?
People studying this say it's education that's needed, either in-house training or outside, at colleges and universities, to get people prepared for the changes and not left behind.
Automation is happening about four times as fast as we can keep up with in education.
Clint Cowden is a dean at Hartnell Community College in Salinas. They offer courses where farm workers learn electric theory and basic hydraulics.
So that when the plant changes, we don't have to do a complete retooling of the employee with a complete retraining, but only small amounts to keep them moving forward.
Training for a new, more skilled and experienced worker who's able to move up. Ana Gutierrez wants to be one of those workers. She says she didn't have the chance to study after high school, after she got married and had her daughter.
Pero pues no se me hizo difícil aprender lo de las máquinas y el robot.
It wasn't difficult learning about the new robot, she says. She gets how they work. And it's less physically demanding work. Now at age 50, she's a machine operator.
Es más fácil aprender cuando los tienes ahí, cuando están funcionando.
Still, the pay isn't a big jump, considering she's been at the company for more than 2 decades. She started at Taylor Farms with $11 an hour. Now she's making $22 an hour.
Si uno se propone las cosas, las puede lograr.
But she says she wants to keep learning and not get stuck or replaced.
Seguir adelante aprendiendo más.
For The World, Marnette Fideris, Salinas, California.
The protests in Hong Kong are now in their 5th month and still going strong. Some local businesses now find themselves being dragged into the confrontation between protesters and authorities in the Chinese territory. Local news reports monitored by the BBC say that Hong Kong businesses have suffered disruption, if not criminal damage, to their storefronts for, quote, kowtowing to Beijing and betraying the mostly young protesters calling for democracy. But we also know that some Hong Kong businesses have publicly supported the protesters. They are demanding an inquiry into what they see as police brutality. And here's a strange twist we've noticed. Protesters have been showing up at demonstrations carrying stuffed animals. Picture this, plush green frogs, and not just any frog.
Pepe is a symbol of this revolution. I've got energy from Pepe.
Energy from Pepe the Frog. Yep, that Pepe, the internet meme that was co-opted by white nationalists in the 2016 U.S. presidential election and even retweeted by President Trump and others.
Donald Trump Jr., for example, he put this image on his Instagram account. It's a meme of Pepe. And for those of you who don't know, Pepe is a white nationalist symbol.
Tomorrow, The World's Patrick Wynn takes us to Hong Kong to find out how an alt-right internet meme became a symbol for Hong Kong democracy protesters.
There are thousands at this unlawful protest, and hundreds of Pepe signs and Pepe dolls, and drawings of this frog scowling or crying out in anger. I turn to another protester named Mandy, asking her to help make sense of this.
Can you tell me about Pepe?
It's hard to explain. We like to use Pepe in our social media to express what we are thinking. He's famous now. He's very famous.
All about the Hong Kong version of Pepe the Frog tomorrow, plus the latest from Syria, the impeachment inquiry, and hey, maybe a little Brexit too. That's all on Friday's edition of The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.